You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
This is the CRM Archaeology Podcast. It's the show where we pull back the veil of cultural resources management, archaeology, and discuss the issues that everyone is concerned about. Welcome to the podcast. Hello and welcome to the CRM Archaeology Podcast, episode 139 for June 20th, 2018. I'm your host, Chris Webster. On today's show, we talk about company policy towards employee welfare. So sharpen those trowels because you're going to want to stab me in the eye and because the CRM Archaeology Podcast starts right now. All right, welcome to the show, everyone. Joining me today is Doug in Scotland.
Hey, everyone.
And Sonia in Utah.
Hello.
Last episode that you guys heard, and if you didn't hear it, please go back and listen. I think it was episode 138. Yeah, because this is 139. So on the last episode, we spent a lot of time talking about something that we had been made aware of. It was a discussion on Facebook. I'm not going to get into who that was because it's not important. It's the topic that's important. And it was about drive time. And it was basically about drive time to a project area, basically. But it's kind of like for daily work, not for, say, a 10-day or an 8-day or something like that, whatever you do, like we do out here in the West. But let's say you're a local field technician and the office doesn't have you come into the office, but they have you just go from your house to the field. And, you know, it's not going to be very far. It's going to be 20, 30 minutes. Otherwise, you'd be living camp, you know, in a hotel somewhere. But it's a local project and you're just asked to drive out to the field and that's your 8-hour day. And in that case, you're not getting per diem because you're going home at the end of the day. You're not getting paid drive time because you're just going to your work site. And if it was an excessive, and I don't know how that defines, maybe Sonia can help me with that, but if it's excessive on the distance that they require you to drive, maybe then some mileage would be covered. But then again, I don't really know. You're driving your own home personal vehicle out to a site. So anyway, we talked about this for an hour on the last episode, but Sonia and Doug weren't on. And Sonia, as a business owner, somebody who's deep in the field season right now, is intimately aware of this and has a very different perspective on this than, say, Stephen and Bill did on the last episode. So for just a few minutes, I want to get Sonia's perspective on this and how that works. Sonia, first, how would you treat a situation where you've got a local field tech and you've got a job that is considered local, not far enough away to get a hotel room, but still is like an hour drive from somebody's home or from your office? How do you deal with that? Is it just kind of like, that sucks, or is there some sort of compensation?
Well, okay, first things first. It always depends on how the contract is written, and sometimes the contract is not written in favor of the company. So the client, for example, may have set rules and requirements on if you are within 2 hours of your project. If your office is within 2 hours of the project area, then no, we're not going to pay for overnight or per diem or drive time or anything like that. So I that's not a choice of the company other than whether or not the company wants to take the project. You understand?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So sometimes it's an hour, sometimes it's 30 minutes. Here's the deal. When you take a local job, your job site, meaning the location where you're conducting your work, is your office.
Mm-hmm.
This is like driving from your home to your office. You don't get paid to drive from home to your office. I don't get paid to drive from my home to my office. When I worked for a company many years ago that I didn't own, when I actually worked for another company, I spent an hour to 2 hours every day just driving from my home to the office, depending on the time of year. During snow, mm-hmm. it was worse time. It took 2 hours to get there. Mm-hmm. It was about 50, 55 miles, I think, from my home. I don't get paid for that time. Being my office location, I don't get paid for it. It's not something mm-hmm. that my company is responsible for. It's my job, when I agreed to take the job, to get myself to my job site. So if you accept a position for a local job, the company's general perspective, and this is not always the case, but in many cases it is, you are responsible to pay for your own mileage to get to your job site, because that's like going to your office. Mm-hmm. Okay. Not like I said before, each contract is written slightly differently. So, for example, I have a job site that is 10 miles away from me, right?
Yeah. That's nice.
It takes, yeah, you know, it's great. It takes me 10 to 15 minutes to get there, maybe 20 minutes max, because I can only drive 35 miles an hour on some of the roads that I'm on, right?
Mm-hmm.
I can, if I've written my contract and my client has accepted that contract with that drive time and with that mileage, then I just go from my home to the site, and I can pay myself, and I can refund mileage for that.
Mm-hmm.
Because the company, my company, and the client agreed to do that. But if
right.
you're accepting a job in maybe Southern California and you need to be within 50 to 100 miles of that job, and you accept it and you get a wage that may be slightly higher than what the surrounding jobs are, like other jobs in the area are, because they are longer term, you're getting comped through your pay rather than through your mileage. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if I need to spell it out any differently for our listeners. Does that make sense to our listeners?
I think it should. You know, the question I have, the big question I have for you as a business owner, and maybe after you see the proposal or you see the request for quote for this job, and then you're crafting a proposal for it, knowing full well what's going to go on, what distance in drive time, like, you know, hour, 2 hour, 3 hour, 4 hours, how far away does the job have to be to where you're in that weird in-between zone where it's getting too far for employees to just drive there because now they have a 12-hour day and, you know, 4 hours of that is driving, or you're getting a hotel room, which means per diem, which means, you know, doubling mm-hmm. the cost of the project. I mean, what is that distance for you?
I usually like to say, like, my personal preference is within an hour to mm-hmm. 2 hours. 2 hours is almost ridiculous.
Yeah.
And that's my personal perspective, but it's not necessarily from the perspective of other companies.
Mm-hmm.
Because 4 hours of drive time daily is a large expenditure, and the company, in my opinion, and this is not, you know, formal in any way, it's just my opinion, should be comping you in some other ways.
Mm-hmm.
I would say an hour. Because
yeah.
in reality, you could live, you know, 40 to 50 miles away from your office and not get paid for that drive time.
Sure, you decide where you live.
You decide where you live, right.
Yeah.
You decide what jobs you accept and which ones you don't. And
sure.
This is part of the conversation that was online. People
mm-hmm.
may say, well, I wouldn't accept that job. But there are others who maybe are not in the same straits as you.
Mm-hmm.
Who would accept that job because they need the work.
Yeah, the challenging thing about being a quote local field tech for a company, for a company that gets a lot of work locally, is this is archaeology. You're not going, it's like construction people, you know, they're not going to the same construction site all the time. Now, they might go for a few months, but then after that, now their commute is to the other side of town or the south end of town or the north end of town or somewhere where they're going. And that's just part of the deal.
Exactly.
You know, they understand that that's part of the deal.
You
there
understand
are some places,
that this is part of the work that you do.
Right.
And
right.
if you don't understand the work that you're getting into, and perhaps this is something that we have, we as a community have not taught our young professionals in archaeology.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't understand that this is part of what this job is, it makes everyone's life a little more difficult, especially when there's a lot of conversation on Facebook and people getting angry about things.
Mm-hmm.
I can't change IRS legislation, you know, the tax legislation. I can't change that from my position right now.
Mm-hmm.
If I were to run for office or if I were to become part of the IRS, perhaps, maybe I could help with that.
Mm-hmm.
But the way tax law is written affects how you get paid for the jobs that you do. Okay.
Right.
And at this point, if you're working a local job, you're not going to get hotel 10 miles away from your home. You're not going to get per diem if you live 10 miles away or if you work 10 miles away from your home. Okay? Right. That's how it is. All right? Now, there could be other members coming from farther away that might be getting that. Mm-hmm. And if you don't think that that's fair, that's on you, not the company. You choose where you live. You choose the jobs that you take. And I hate to sound like a hard ass on this, but
I mean,
at the same time,
that's the reality of adulting, though, isn't it?
It is. I mean, when I was observing this conversation, I was just like, what? my husband's job is an hour and a half away from here. He travels a lot for work. Okay, he doesn't get paid for his flight time.
Right.
He gets paid 40 hours a week, okay, mm-hmm. because he's salaried. Now, you know, but at the same time, even if he was hourly, he would still have to drive his sorry butt an hour and a half down the road in the morning to get to his job and to drive an hour and a half home on good weather days. Mm-hmm. He doesn't get paid for that time. He doesn't get a hotel to stay down south when the weather's bad. You know, or because it's so far away. That's just the job.
Yeah.
Understand, when you go into this work, understand what you're getting yourselves into. Mm-hmm. And this is part of what this podcast is intended for.
Absolutely.
To help educate you. And I wish we had, and I hope we have, a lot of young professionals who are still getting their degrees and getting more experience that are going to start understanding this. And this is perhaps where we have failed you. We as mm-hmm. as more experienced professionals and professors.
Sure.
You know, in this situation, I really wish Bill was on so that we could have a conversation about that.
Yeah. Well, Bill, you should, I haven't, as of this recording, I haven't released the last episode where we spent a lot of time talking about this, but I think you'll be interested to hear Bill's thoughts on this. And maybe after both of these comes out, we'll have all you guys on again to discuss this one more time once you've heard each other's opinions, because they're pretty striking. But, mm-hmm. you know, as you said, Sonia, you choose where you live and you know what the job is entailing and you know what's happening. When I was in the Navy, it wasn't my first job, but it was my first like real adult kind of job. And I'd worked in high school a little bit, but when I got into the Navy, that was like, no shit, here we go. And I got married a little while after being in the Navy. And even before I was married, though, my girlfriend at the time, or fiance or whatever she was, we were living just because where she was working and what was going on. And we were doing this illegally because in the Navy, I had to be less than a half an hour away from the base in case I got called in. But they didn't know where I was able to somehow fly under that radar. but I was a good hour and a half away, you know, probably an hour if I really sped down the interstate in Seattle. But I was a good hour and a half away from the base. And I drove that every day, 5 days a week, sometimes more when I had a watch or duty on the weekend. And it was my choice, you know, and eventually we moved closer. But that was my choice. And people that live in big cities, like, you know, I think the traffic in Seattle or Los Angeles or San Francisco, you know, any of those big cities, you choose where you live and you choose what jobs you're going to take. And if you're a local field tech, well, you know that your job is going to send you around the local area and you're not going to get per diem for that. That's just the way it's going to be. Like we said, construction.
Yeah, it is very much like construction. And there are other jobs very similar to this. And I just, I know that people want to make a change. I mm-hmm. know that, and I understand that. The thing is if you're out working for some other company, like, I don't know, let's say you're going to go work for Apple. You know what I mean? If you're going to go work for Apple Computers, you're going to need to drive your sorry butt from your home to your office. And Apple mm-hmm. is not going to pay you for that time. They're also not going to pay you for that mileage. And if it's bad weather, they're not going to put you up in a hotel. That's not their responsibility. It's your responsibility to get yourself to your job. Okay?
Yeah.
And I know I sound powerful and heartless, but at the same time, this is about being an adult. Sorry, go ahead.
Well, one of the things we were going to talk about today is company policy and how you can craft that around laws and situations, basically. I mean, not breaking laws, obviously, but you can create company policy that can maybe help people in certain ways. And one of those things I'm thinking about, like, for example, sometimes companies will cover part of a cell phone bill or something like that if they're not going to supply phones, but they expect you to use it for work. Some companies supply a boot allowance every year so they can pay for boots. Those are things they don't have to do, but things they do that are just nice to haves. And one thing that that I think I would probably do, I haven't had this situation yet, but if I had a bunch of local people and all of a sudden we got a job that was in, you know, that was a long ways away, but it was not in a way that we could actually go out there and stay or camp for some whatever reason, maybe you could just give a bonus at the end of the project or at the end of every couple of weeks for pay or something like that, that maybe is a flat, you know, here's some compensation for your mileage and wear and tear in your car, but we're just going to call it a bonus and do that. You know, it's not going to be every time, but for this project, that's what we're going to do. I'm going to take a hit or something like that. So
exactly. And those are things that I've done before. Like, for example, working on holidays, I don't believe in most states that it is the law to pay double time. You can work on a holiday for regular time, but because I appreciate the work that my crew is doing, I have chosen and I have written my company policy to provide double time to my crews.
Sure.
That doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to be working a full 8 hours. You might work four, but because you're getting double time, you're getting paid as if you're working 8 hours. Yep. Now, when I pay double time for 4 hours, say somebody makes, I don't know, $15 an hour or $20 an hour. Let's say $20 because it makes math a little easier. Okay? So if I'm paying somebody $20 an hour to go out and tech for me and they're getting double time for 4 hours, they're getting paid $40 an hour, but I'm only billing them out at $35 an hour to the client, which, by the way, is a pathetic billing rate. Just want you to know how I feel about billing rates in archaeology.
Right.
Especially for professionals. If I'm billing that field tech out at $35 an hour, and I'm responsible for paying for doubling, so you guys pay your federal taxes, like we'd have to deduct that out of your wages, my company has to double that. So if you're getting paid $20 an hour and you've got, let's say, $10 in taxes, or I don't, it's probably less than that. It's probably like $2 in taxes. I'm now paying $42 toward your hourly rate or toward what you get paid, right? I'm also paying for all the insurance. So all of a sudden now I'm paying $45 an hour, and I'm paying for your per diem, half a per diem, and your full hotel that day. Okay, let's start tacking on all that stuff. I am taking a loss on what I'm paying you, but I'm choosing to do that because it makes you more productive in the long run. It makes you feel appreciated, and that's why I choose to do that. So I have written my company policy to help benefit my crews because your work is important to me. How you perceive your job and how you do your job is important to me because it's important to our business. It's important for you to get called back to do additional work. It's important for the client to call us back, right? So I've written my company policy to reward my employees, even though it costs us money in the long run. Okay?
Well, yeah, but it, but on the other hand, it also probably saves you money when they do better work. So
exactly,
you know, it's a,
that
it's
means
a give
I don't
and take.
Have to go out and repeat work.
Yeah, exactly. Which I've done quite a bit of times for other companies when I was a crew chief. We'd had to go out and re-record stuff because other people did it shoddily. So, all right, well, you know, we're up against a break right now, so we're going to pick this up on the other side with a few more comments on this topic, and then we'll move on to some other things. So we'll be back in just a minute.
This network is listener supported. We're trying to move away from paid advertising while also creating new shows and supporting the ones we have. The APN has never and will never make a serious profit on our podcast. Every little dime we make goes back into the network and improving show quality. So become a member today at www.arcpodnet.com/members to show your support, get some extras, and be a benefactor for archaeological education. Members get stickers, a coffee mug, a t-shirt, bonus content, early access to episodes, a private Slack team to talk to other members and the hosts, and full access to training on Team Black over at arccert.black. So check out our memberships at www.arcpodnet.com/members today and support archaeological education. That's www.arcpodnet.com/members. Now back to the show.
All right, welcome back to the CRM Archaeology Podcast. And when we ended the last section, we were talking about basically drive time, but more importantly, company policy. Again, like we talked about the entire last episode, but we've got some different perspectives on this time. So we're going to pick that back up. I know Doug's got a few things to say about this, and I know Sonia's got some few more things to say about policy and rewards. So Sonia, we were talking over the break. Why don't you just kick right back into that and say, you know, everybody needs to work for your company because you give them an extra $10,000 a year, right?
I don't know if it's an extra $10,000 a year, but I don't get an extra $10,000 a year. But, you know, anyway, I do try to reward employees, especially at the end of the year, employees that have worked for us repeatedly or over longer jobs. We sit down and we have like a end of the year party, kind of a holiday party sort of a thing. And one of the things that I try to do is provide a little bit of a bonus. It just, especially to individuals who are stepping up, actually putting themselves out there and saying, you know what, I have feedback on this issue. I want positive feedback on this issue. I want to talk about something we could make, some way we could make the job better. People that actually step up are ones that we want to reward, but we also want to reward crew who are doing their jobs and doing them well. So, you know, I have a book that's called 1001 Ways to Reward Employees. It's by Bob Nilsen, PhD. And nice. I purchased this book many, many, many years ago. This was well before I even started my own company. And kind of just looked through it. And it talks about different types of parties, individual things, like things that you can do to help people out and to reward them. Like you were saying.
How many ways do you have left?
Oh, a lot. I have a lot.
Nice.
Like you were saying in the first segment, purchasing boots for someone, memberships to different archaeology associations, sending them to conferences. These are all different types of rewards, but because they not only benefit you, but they benefit the company in its exposure, research and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, even like parties and gifts, the federal tax law limits us to spending $100 in a gift, like a regular gift, a present for you. But what I can do beyond that is purchase you field equipment.
Mm-hmm.
Or pay for your trips to go to the SAAs, or different types of things. Companies can reward you for this. They can give you bonuses. Now, just as a heads up, bonuses are taxed differently than regular income, so keep that in mind. But there are a lot of things that companies can do to help their employees out and to help them feel appreciated. So now I'm talking more toward leadership, company leadership, and less so to the field crew. But to you field crew members, the way to get these rewards is to do good work, is to not always be talking negatively and griping about stuff, to provide feedback. And when I say feedback, I'm talking about constructive feedback. It doesn't always need to be positive, because I said positive earlier. Constructive, not destructive feedback. Mm-hmm. Stick your neck out there and say, hey, I have an idea. I think this might work better.
Yeah.
Those are ways that you can be rewarded for taking a step up and doing good work. So
Mm-hmm.
In terms of, like, bringing this full circle, in terms of getting your drive time comped, I hate to say it, guys, but because it's not standard in any industry, or I shouldn't say any, that's pretty all-inclusive, in 99% of industries, that's not going to happen all the time unless it's written into the contract, okay? And sometimes that's not up to the company.
Right.
You're not always going to get per diem. You're not always going to get hotel. You're not always going to get mileage. Okay? That's just how it is. Yeah. I hate to sound like a hard ass, but there it is.
There it is.
Be an adult. This is an adult job. Okay?
Yeah. And, you know, before we bring Doug in for some comments and some perspectives from the other side of the pond here, I got to say, we saw, I was looking at this morning, or last night or whatever it was, I was on Facebook, and somebody I know, a friend of mine, put up a Facebook video of a project she's on, and, you know, she was showing something, whatever. It was just a little tiny video. It wasn't even about the project. And my wife was like, oh, man, she must always get on good projects. She always seems, you know, happy and stuff like that. And I was like, no, she just has a good attitude. It's like, she's on crappy projects. We all are, you know, crappy for one reason or another. And somebody's crappy project, maybe somebody else's good project. And it's just about perspective. And she just always seems to have a positive attitude. And I'll bet she has her negative days. I'll bet she has her depressing days where she's just like, why am I still doing this? But the thing is, she doesn't put that out there. She doesn't put that out there and whine and cry about it. She puts out positive things. So it looks like she's always a positive person. And I'll tell you what, that reflects on her as an employee too. If it was between her and somebody else that's always posting negative things on Facebook for me as an employer, I'm probably going to hire her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She's going to hire the positive person and not the negative person. Seriously.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, I've had my share of negative attitude employees, and I'll tell you, I give you a few chances to change that around, that attitude around. And if you don't step up and absolutely nothing is good for you, you're done.
Mm-hmm.
Honestly, I can't have that poison spreading throughout my entire crew. And it is poison. And God's honest truth, I cannot stand it. I know the work sucks. I know it's hard. I've been there. I've been doing this for 20 years. I'm not just one of those company owners that doesn't know or have any understanding of what's going on in the field. I've been stalked by wild animals. I have to carry a gun. I am I am not out of touch with this. So if you can't be positive, or at least try, I mean, I recognize that sometimes days are just shitty. But if you're negative all the time, you're not going to move forward.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So speaking of moving forward, Doug, you've been listening quietly for 31 minutes almost, and well, actually 27 minutes. So what are your thoughts on this? What are your thoughts on this topic, either from a personal standpoint, from what you've done in CRM, or from a European standpoint, from stuff you've done over there?
Yeah, I want to know how it's different between Europe and the U.S.
Okay, well, first, I can't speak for all of Europe. similar to how it's a bit different on the East Coast, how they do archaeology from the West Coast in the United States. Each country, while similar, has its own little quirks and ways of doing things. What I could say is generally this would not be too much of an issue in European archaeology, in that you don't travel very far distances to go to your project. This is going to, again, differ from certain countries. So certain countries will be highly centralized where they just have one government organization that does all the archaeology, and so you might then be centralized and moving about. But say the UK, where very similar system to the US, private companies bidding, and they're working for essentially the developers and the other contractors. And there's a local government who requests that the archaeology happens, but doesn't undertake it. You know, very similar system. But in the UK, it's such a tiny country. It is so tiny that basically companies can't afford to really have projects several hours from their office. So jobs like in Scotland where they send you up to the Highlands, yes, that will be, you know, paid for, that's per diem and stuff like that. But it's so dense. It's like being on the East Coast, you know, up near New York and Boston and all that area. It's the country is so dense that if you have to pay for any sort of travel or any overnight stay, chances are you're going to lose out the bid because that's just going to raise your prices so much. You're going to lose it out to someone who is, it'll literally be in their backyard. And so a lot of companies, even for like remote areas, will have an archaeologist that they hire in, so they might subcontract to. So if it's just like, say, somewhere in the borders and the company's based in Edinburgh, they won't even just pay, they just won't add the petrol costs, the cost for gasoline to go down there, because it just would be too much. They'll hire someone who's local to that area. And so you have what you'd call sort of local archaeologists who basically will be the subcontracted person for all the bigger companies. And so this isn't too much of an issue. There will be some projects that are more remote, wind farms up in, you know, the hills or something like that. And it gets a bit complex. So there's EU-wide regulations that apply to the 28 countries that are part of it. So this covers most of Europe. And it'll really depend on if you're considered having a set office or not. So if you don't have a set office, and this probably applies a lot more times when they're subcontracting people in, then you have to pay for the travel time. And this comes from the court cases around this have more to do with like telecommunications and stuff, where companies would basically send someone for like a 3-hour drive and then count their time from when they first got to that location and not the 3-hour drive, because they never actually went into an office. They basically, if you have no set office, then you have to pay for travel time from essentially where they live.
Yeah.
But if you do have a set office, then that doesn't apply. And it'll be on a case-by-case basis. Most of the companies will, like, let's say if you're being sent far away, they will pay for the part of that travel time. But mm-hmm. it's a pretty rare case. And basically, it's assumed that if you're digging or, you know, basically, it's you're not being paid for that time, that travel time, if it's close enough. So that's how it kind of works. And that's EU-wide regulations that apply through half the countries in Europe. But it is, again, very different. But it's something that's just not going to come up a lot, because you're not going to have to travel very far. Like in mm-hmm. one case, it may be that so what I've done in the past is actually you have to get to the dig or the excavation yourself, and many times it's actually closer to get to the excavation from where I'm living than it is to get to the office. So, you know, I save some time on the digs when I go out. So it is very different, and it's almost a non-issue here, except in very specific places that, you know, bits of Scotland, parts of Cornwall, the more remote locations. And occasionally it may be that you're going out, but then like in those cases, if you go to the office and use a company vehicle, then you're getting paid for that time. So I guess it's all a bit complicated, but it's not like the Western US where, you know, you may be going for an hour or two drive to get to a site. It just doesn't happen that much.
Do you think that's, I mean, that's the primary reason why people aren't really talking about it? Because it kind of surprises me that any point at which the job is costing you a little bit extra money would be a sore point for people. And maybe it's a cultural thing over there. They just don't want to complain about it. But I always hear how low the salaries are for archaeologists in the UK. So you'd think that every little bit where they could save money, they'd probably be trying to get something out of their company or say something about it. But just nobody's having that conversation, huh? Regarding drive time anyway.
Again, it's such a rare thing because most excavations are happening in cities and towns. So you're actually taking public transportation. There's very few archaeologists. Half the population doesn't have a driver's license. Actually, a lot of job adverts in the UK, your degree is almost meaningless. If you have a CSCS card, which basically it's a requirement for working in construction, it's health and safety, but being able to work on a construction site, and if you have a driver's license, that will get you a job before any degree will, and possibly a couple of years of experience. Because essentially, a lot of archaeologists don't have a vehicle, but if you, say, need to pick up the company vehicle and drive it there, that not many people have a driver's license, so it's a big deal. And so that actually will keep you on a job more than experience, and it will get you a job easily. Your degree is almost pointless when it comes to your first entry-level job. Get a driver's license, it'll go so much further. So it's not that big of a deal. And, you know, sometimes what it'll be is like you get to take the company car home with you. So when you're driving, which means you don't have to pay for, you guys can't see it, but air quotes, petrol. So in the UK, it's called petrol. Well, we call it gasoline in the States. So in a sense, that's actually, you're driving the company car, but you're not having to actually pay for transportation. So you know, it's a little bit more mixed than that. And pay is pretty similar to the US. Not so much because the pound has gone down, but when you convert dollar to pound, pay is fairly similar. It's all crap for entry level. So, there's that stuff. And also the regulations are different. So some of those perks that Sonia was talking about are regulated by law that they have to give people. So any personal protection equipment, so steel cap boots, water. So it rains here, waterproofs. The company actually has to pay for that. So some companies will just give you the equipment, or some will give you, like, say, a 200 or 100 pound equipment allowance, and then you can go spend it how you'd like to get the equipment you need. But it is required by law to pay for stuff like that. So if you have anything related to your work that's, you know, personal protection equipment and could be claimed as such, the company has to pay for it. So there's a bit more generosity in the legal sense over here of what's required of employers, but it's required of everyone. So it makes the field pretty level, so you can't undercut people by not, you know, being cheap on personal protection equipment. You just can't do it. So there's that. But back to, do you guys, if you don't mind going back to sort of, I have a bit of a stickler on how we've kind of phrased some things earlier in the conversation. And it's just to say, I don't think we should be using the term quite so much, quite so liberally, choice. I think we should say is there's the realities of getting a job in archaeology, and that may not work well with your personal circumstances. But I do want to be a bit particular in saying that I know we've sort of mentioned up there, and I don't want to like put words in your guys' mouth or anything like that, but when we're saying like, oh, you know, you choose to live someplace, that's not necessarily true of a lot of people. Like, you know, if you're only making a certain amount of money, there's going to be a limited choice of where you can possibly live and what you could possibly do. And I'd say is to get a job in CRM, it's not going to be flexible in a lot of senses. In some senses, it will be flexible, but in others, it's not going to be flexible. And so I'd say we've sort of put it on personal choice for people, and ultimately it is their personal choice. But I do think we shouldn't say stuff like they've chosen to live someplace and, you know, things like that, because it's not always a choice.
Right. But those choices, I mean, that when I say somebody chooses to live someplace, sure, they may not have been able to choose out of very many options because of the lifestyle that they've also chosen, or the job that they've chosen, or the career that they've chosen. But at some point, these people were in college because a college degree is required for all these jobs. And at some point they said, I'm going to be an archaeologist. And then at some point they said, I'm going to be a CRM archaeologist. And like anything else, if they did not research what that meant, and that might just be listening to us tell you what this means. But if they didn't research what that meant and look into their job industry, call some employers and do some things, that's a choice. That is a choice. And if that all led to, I live here because I only make $20,000 a year, that's also a choice. I mean, I hate to say it to you, but that's also a choice. So
I'd also like to add that, you know, when I did some initial research into becoming an archaeologist, I went online. Okay, maybe not back in like the early 90s, but later on, when the internet was, you know, bigger. I went online and looked into, well, how much do professional archaeologists get paid? And honest to God, I was like, dang, $55,000 a year? That's awesome. Yeah. No, that's right. Incredibly misleading, because it's a huge average of like everybody. And the problem is young folk are looking at that and going, wow, I'm going to make $55,000 a year, or however much it is. It should have been somewhere around there. And they're not being taught that early.
Mm-hmm.
And that again is another shortcoming or a failing of our educational system. We're not understanding that you're literally making like $28,000, $30,000 a year to start, and probably for the next 10 years of your life, depending on how eager you are to move forward.
Yeah. And the lifestyle that you choose, how you choose to spend your money. If you're going to have kids and a family during that time when you're making $28,000 a year, then, you know, that's not going to stretch very far.
It's not going to stretch far at all. I mean, if you came from a, you know, middle to upper class lifestyle to begin with and said, yeah, I'm going to go into archaeology, going to Starbucks every morning to get your coffee is going to become one of those luxuries that's going to break the bank, you know?
Yeah.
And once you hit, what is it, 26 or 28 or something now, that you can't be on your parents' insurance?
Something like that, yeah.
It gets a little more challenging.
Right. Okay, well, we're going to take our final break and then wrap up this discussion on the other side. And during that break, I'm going to run to Starbucks and get my $6 cup of coffee. Back in a second.
Hey, podcast fans and digital archaeologists. Have you heard about WildNote? It's a data collection app that works online or offline on your smartphone or tablet, iOS or Android. It allows you to collect field data easily, manage data efficiently, and generate data reports and site records effortlessly. We have a growing list of state site forms built in for your use, and some generic forms that will work anywhere. Check out the shovel testing and photograph forms. You can get a free all-access 30-day trial today by going to wildnoteapp.com. That's wildnoteapp.com for your free 30-day trial. Now back to the show.
Okay, we're back with the Drive Time Part 2 episode, where we talk about the same thing that we talked about the entire last episode, but in a different way, which is a really great thing, because this lets people know that things are different. Everybody has a different perspective on stuff, which is fantastic, and why I wanted to do this. So we're going to continue.
Yeah, you're going to get company owners. You're going to get company owners saying something different than employees.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, which kind of reminds me as a little bit of a segue into something I hadn't planned on talking about, but I've been thinking about for a really long time. If you're listening to this and you're a field technician, I don't care if you started working last week or if you've been a field technician for 40 years, I kind of want to start bringing on maybe once every other episode. I like to do it every episode, but I don't want to get too ambitious. And have, like, as a guest host, a field technician, because all the hosts of this show are graduate-level archaeologists that have done, you know, other things and maybe haven't been field techs in a long time. And so, you know, we're able to speak at that level, but I want to make sure we're also grounded and that we get the impressions of the field tech. So if you're interested, send me an email, chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. We record at 9 a.m. Pacific time on every other Sunday. And that's all you just need a set of headphones and we'll work the rest of it out. So if you're interested in that, let me know, because I'd like to get some guest hosts on here and just talk about it. We're not going to talk about you. You're just going to chime in on the conversation. So anyway, with this shorter segment here, we're going to continue the company policy discussion and talk about, I had a couple notes down here, double occupancy and per diem, because we mentioned it in other shows, but kind of pushed it off to its own topic. So let's just kick this off then with some more policy stuff. Again, double occupancy. We've talked about this before. We'll talk about it again. I freaking hate double occupancy. And every time I see a job posting that says double occupancy hotel, that tells me at least one thing, that the PI has no idea how to bid on projects, how to budget projects, or they don't care about their employees, because no adult should have to sleep in a room with another adult for an extended period of time unless that's by choice. If you give somebody $150 a day per diem and they choose to room together to save money, well, that's on them. But if you force them to room together, then I'm sorry, but that's just too far. I don't care what the circumstances are. That's too far. So
I have something to say about this.
I'm sure you do.
And I agree with you 100%. I absolutely hate double occupancy hotels. However, it is not always going to work out the way you want it to. So, for example, I have a project up north in a really, really remote part of Idaho. There are only so many rooms available to us. We have four rooms available to us through a lodge, a hunting lodge, and we have six to eight employees that are needed to complete the project on schedule. Mm-hmm. So here are the options. You have double occupancy hotel, which, by the way, may or may not have Wi-Fi. And if it does, it sucks because it's in an area where there is no cell coverage or any fiber optic or mm-hmm. pretty much anything. Or you can camp.
Yeah.
And because the hotel or the company is paying for hotels, you're not getting a choice. So what do you do? Now, I had this conversation online with someone about this, and they said, well, the company should have planned better. Okay? The company should have planned better. In what way? How could mm-hmm. they have planned better? The next closest hotel is 3.5 to 4 hours away. So do you want 8 hours of round trip travel plus another 8 hours of work during the day?
Mm-hmm.
Or do you want to actually sleep at night and rest?
Right.
It doesn't always work the way you want it. And it's not always because the company didn't plan well and doesn't care about their employees.
Sure. And I don't want to say that that's always the case. You know, sometimes you're right. Sometimes there really aren't very many other choices. But that being said, I guess my point with the whole thing is I still want to put the choice on to the employee. And even if this hunting lodge is the only thing around that you guys can possibly stay in, then leave it to the employees to find that hunting lodge, or you rent out the entire hunting lodge as the company owner and then rent the rooms out to them. I mean, either way, it's a choice. I don't want to be forced to have to stay there. If I want to camp or if I want to stay in a hotel 3 hours away, just give me the per diem and let me make that choice. That's my only thing.
The hunting lodge is not just a hotel. It's a business. It takes people out. It takes hunters out. That's their business. Renting out an entire hunting lodge is not good for the project, because renting out the hunting lodge could quite literally cost about $5,000 to $7,000 a day.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, you know, I get it.
I mean,
yeah.
there's no, if not more, because people to pay $5,000 to $10,000 for a 3-day hunting trip.
Yeah.
So keep that in mind. It is not always planned, and it is not always intended to harm the employees. Because honestly, I hate double occupancy as much as anybody else does. Mm-hmm. To me, it opens up the company to risk. There's many different types of risk. I mean, I've seen knockdown, blowout, drag out, fights happen because of double occupancy. I've seen sexual harassment happen because of double occupancy. I mean, like I said, 20 years of experience here. I've been around the block a few times. I've seen people pull guns on other people. That ain't
fun. Sure.
You know?
Yeah. And this project you're talking about, Sonia, is probably, honestly, it's probably an outlier project.
It is.
I mean, yeah,
they're very
we're talking
few
about
and far
the
between.
Average project.
Yeah, yeah, average projects. And then there's also the super sketch hotels that you have that can get, I mean, that doesn't really have much to do with double occupancy, but, you know, just to add it, that there's, you know, the hooker mm-hmm. hotels, those are scary. Sometimes it's better to have two people in those rooms than right. one. You know, there's all sorts of different scenarios that young professionals or new professionals may not be considering. So please don't always assume that the field director doesn't care about its employees or that they didn't plan or budget correctly. There's a lot of thought that goes into these things. Now, to be honest, sometimes that is 100% the case. The field director didn't give a crap. The project manager didn't give a crap. The company, the client was like, no, we want to double people up, whatever. Sometimes that is the case and it sucks.
Yeah. And when, my experience with discussing this topic entirely comes from working in the Southeast and Southeastern United States. And it was, and I don't mean the outlier project like you're talking about. Like if a company 80% of the time just gives you per diem and says figure it out, then that's fine. But on that one project where there's only one place to stay and the company has to, you know, reserve it or do something, then sure, as long as people know what's happening going in, again, you make choices and you say, I want to do that project or I don't, and then you go from there. But when it's company policy to double up, like it is for a lot of the companies in the Southeast, it's just simply company policy is to double up, and that's how they bid on projects.
Oh,
that's
hell
what
no.
I'm talking
All right,
about.
Guys, I'm going to stir the pot just a little bit. Yeah, so how does that differ from our conversation about travel? So I look at this in the sense of, I would like a job that would pay me for travel. I'd also like a job that wouldn't do double occupancy. And obviously we've talked about, you know, that's not the realities of CRM. And I mean, you basically have to go into a different profession that will pay you to drive time and pay you for, you know, not to do double occupancy. But are we not just saying it's basically slightly different version of the drive time conversation, only we're talking about hotels instead of driving? Or do you guys see this as something different?
I see it as something different because per diem, I wrote this in my notes, per diem is really what I'm talking about. And double occupancy and hotel rooms in general are just a side offshoot of the per diem conversation because it's paid for out of per diem typically. So even if the company's paying for it, it's paid for based on, you know, the rates that are for that area for hotel rooms and things like that. And that's what they put into their bid. So per diem for an archaeologist is like tips for waitstaff. We don't hesitate. Well, at least in this country, we don't hesitate to tip because we feel bad that the person serving us is getting paid $2.50 an hour because that's what they're allowed to get paid, and they make their money on tips. Well, archaeologists, it just should be acknowledged, they make up their shitty income. They make it to a livable level because of per diem, and then they're going to make their choices on where they want to live and how they want to live based on per diem. So if an archaeologist is young, has no bills, no family, no anything like that, and they want to stay in a 5-star hotel, then let them. But if another person has bills and maybe has a family and is supporting people in the background and wants to hook up with somebody else that's also doing that and save some money in the hotel, then they should be able to do that. But when it comes down to drive time, that's a different conversation because that's just that's just not part of per diem. That's not, that's just driving to work. You know, that's like what Sonia said, that's expected that you're going to drive to work if you're doing a local thing.
But per diem is not,
per diem is a different
but
deal.
It's not a legal requirement.
Exactly. And not, so
in some cases, so if you, it will be a legal requirement for, I know some federal requirements and stuff like that, but it's not, per diem is not a worker's right.
Nope, it's not.
Sure. But try doing a project without one.
Yeah, but that this is what I'm saying is like, we're expecting that. I think it's our conversation is actually, you know, double occupancy is going to happen sometimes because there's not enough money. But in the same sense, we could get paid for our drive time. There are other professions that get paid for their drive time. I'm saying I don't see them being very different. And I think we should be definitely giving the advice that, you know, this is the realities of archaeology, but I don't think we can separate the two. I think we should either demand both drive time and per diem at a certain level, and anything else right. is just going to be a choice.
So let me tell you how I'm separating the two. If you get per diem on the job, okay, so all the factors and all the stars aligned and you're getting per diem on the job, then that per diem should just be a flat rate per diem and you get to choose your hotel, you make it to the project on time, you do everything you're going to do. If there's no per diem, if there's just simply no per diem, then that discussion doesn't happen, you know? So if there's no per diem because it's a local project, or no per diem because that's just how it was bid and there's no per diem, you still make a choice on whether or not you're going to do that project. And that's how it's separated from drive time. You know what I mean?
But then because you're making the decision on what per diem you'll accept, because there's no standard per diem. They can give you per diem however they want to give it to you. And each company has its own policy and is allowed to do
that. I agree. I agree with that.
Yeah. I mean, if you're coming back to, you're basically making a request. And I'd say, you know, if we're saying it's all choice, then how you get your per diem, you're making that choice. And if you get paid for driving or not, you're making that choice as well. Unfortunately, the realities of CRM is there's not really a lot of money to be able to let, you won't have many options when making your choices is how I should put it.
I'd like to add something to this conversation, especially with regard to drive time. There's two different types of drive time. There's driving from your home to your office, wherever that office may be, or your staging area. Let's call it your staging area. You drive from your home to your staging area, which in most cases is considered your office, or if you're working a local project, it is your project site. Once you hit your project site, your time starts. Or your staging area, your time starts. Okay, so I am a huge advocate of billing time, even though it's driving and it sucks for the company. I'm an advocate of paying people from the hotel or from the job site to wherever they're working. Okay, does that make sense? Mm-hmm. So, for example, my job is reasonably local. Each morning, I have to go meet at a big warehouse with the rest of the contractors to go through a health and safety meeting. I don't get to charge time from my hotel to my job site, to my staging area, to that area where I have that meeting. Once I hit that meeting, my time starts, and then I can drive to my location. So say I'm monitoring an archaeological site, or I'm checking birds or whatever it is I'm doing along the corridor. Okay, so there's two different types of drive time that we've been discussing. All right, from your home to your staging area, and from your staging area to your job site. Okay. Mm-hmm. Then second, per diem is not required, and you're absolutely right. We can pay it however we want to. Additionally, per diem, hotel cost and per diem, your daily per diem rate, do not need to be paid to you together. The company has a policy in place, and they can pay that however they feel they want to. Per diem, as everybody thinks they deserve it, is defined for federal employees only. That federal per diem rate that you always see is, oh, it's $51 a day for this area, and it's $95 a day in this area. You're mm-hmm. because unless you're a federal employee, you have no right to that money. Okay?
Right.
The company can pay you however they want. That's how they get away with stuff like camping per diem, or which I'm not a huge fan of because it costs more to camp than it does to do anything else. But
yeah, just to say real quick,
sure.
I think in some cases it can be forced to apply on subcontractors.
Some.
But it's not, that has to be put into the contract. So
it does.
It can be forced, but Sonia's saying, it's basically, it's in most cases it's not. And mm-hmm. when people are talking about it, they're just sort of making it up as they go.
Yeah, you're not due. If you're working on a federal contract, you're not due $51 a day. Your company could say, we're going to pay you $45. They can sure. They can do that however they want to. And some companies sure. pay per diem and hotel in a lump sum cost to their employees in cash at the beginning of the contract. My company doesn't do that. I have had plenty of employees who have quite literally walked off contracts on day one after they have received a fistful of cash. I don't do
sure,
that. There's
that
no
happens.
Way to recover that.
No.
And
but,
it happens.
But you'll never hire them again, and you won't give them a reference
That's
either.
True.
So.
But there's no way to recover yeah. that.
No.
I prefer to pay the cost of the hotel through my business, because I can often get something, it's called direct bill. So this is on more of the upper management side. It's called direct bill. Essentially, they'll send us a bill at the end of the month for, 30 days of hotel time, which is a lot of money.
Yeah.
Additionally, one of the other reasons why I do it that way is because having been a young archaeologist without a lot of credit and no credit card, there was no way for me to pay for a hotel. When I was young. So
sure.
a lot of archaeologists can't afford that. Some of them even struggle to pay for food. I mean, I saw one young lady who bought herself a 40-pound bag of rice from Costco and lugged it around with her and cooked it in the coffee pot at the hotel room because she couldn't afford food.
Yeah, and what was the reason behind that?
What was the reason?
Other people working on that job could afford food, and they're getting paid the same amount. This all comes down to choices.
Mm-hmm. Many times, yeah.
Well, no, because if you're just, well, yes and no, but in a sense of like, if it's your first job and you haven't been working in a while, you have no cash reserves to be able to buy that food before you get reimbursed.
That's totally bullshit. If it's your first job and you haven't been working, say, over the, maybe it's your first job ever, I'll give you that one. That's a one-off. But if it's your first job of the season and you were off for 5 months, but you didn't plan to be off for 5 months and you had no money in the bank or you didn't get a job over the winter, that's not my fault.
Yeah, well, no one's saying it's your fault. We're just saying that there's a reason why some people, are buying
yeah.
40-pound bags of rice. And it could just be they maybe had 6 or 8 months without work. Stuff
sure.
happens and you have no cash reserves whatsoever. And it's that or, say, get a credit card and go into a massive credit card debt. So maybe, that she could be making the smartest choice that she has, which
buy
is...
buy the 40-pound...
In the long run, it'll
yeah.
probably save...
It will.
Yeah.
So
in the long run, it'll probably save her money because she's not, doing payday loans or credit card and stuff like that. It just sucks for when she starts out to, get the 40-pound bag of rice. But, next paycheck, she'll have
exactly.
money.
Hopefully.
Hopefully. Or, maybe it is that she's actually, maybe she's seriously, seriously into debt. And this is her smart choice to, she's cut all of her expenses to the bone just
work.
So she can pay off
work.
The debt faster.
Yeah.
Now,
yeah.
I mean, and yeah. not to sound insensitive and contrary to what I've just been saying, I do pay per diem at the end of the project on the pay cycle. We do everything on a pay cycle. So it's... When I have people coming to me saying, can I get an advance on my paycheck? Can I get an advance on my per diem? And I'm mm-hmm. I don't make a habit of doing that.
Sure.
I don't know you. I don't know if you're good for it. You have to establish credit with me the same way you have to establish credit with a credit card company. You know what I mean? I mean, it's, it may sound insensitive, and it's not intending to be. It's business.
No, it's not insensitive. It's you not being responsible for other people's decisions when they come to you for work. I mean, that's just smart. So, all right, well, we've gone way over time on this, so I'm going to, you know, shut this down. I'm glad you guys had your... And I think we may even bring up per diem in the next episode because we could just keep on talking about this. And I'm glad.
I think it's great. It's a great conversation.
Well, yeah. And I'm glad you guys brought up the legalities of it because I don't think a lot of people know that because they do think per diem is a right and not a thing that the company is giving you. That being said, you know, it's become, because per diem is more, is given more often than it's not, it's become like tipping in a restaurant. You're still not required to tip. I can get my food at a classy $500 a plate restaurant if I want and not leave any tip at all. Nobody's going to, you know, they might spit in my food the next time I walk in the door, but nobody, it's not illegal, right? So like, because of that, it's the same thing with per diem. It's become an expected thing. Like if I go take this job that's $15 an hour, but it's $130 a day per diem, that's okay. Or if I take a job that's $20 an hour and it's only $90 a day per diem, well, maybe that's okay. Yeah. You know, those are the choices that I make, mm-hmm. but it's become kind of an expected thing. And if employers want to keep employing people, if they're not going to, and this is, Sonia, this is a completely other conversation that I'd like to have with you at some point, maybe off okay. the air first, but if employers don't regionally get together and start setting prices for contracts.
That's illegal.
Well, I start agreeing to ranges,
that's
though.
That's price setting.
I know it
that's
is.
That's illegal.
But it has to be done. It has to be done where we start saying, listen, we're not going to bid below this point. We're not going to fix the price, but we're not going to bid below this much per acre in this area. And that's just
price fixing, and it's illegal. I mean, I hate to say that.
I don't care.
There's always one that will right. underbid it.
I don't care. It's not...
Chris, the only way you could do that and... All right, watch people like freak out. But honestly, there's a reason why there's unions, because a union can set a price and then force all the companies to do it or pay the union rate. Though eventually, if you get a company that isn't part of the union, then they of course undercut. But yeah, you can't price fit. Or what you could do is you can go and say talk to your SHPO, and the state or the federal government could set rates that people have to be paid.
The Fed does do that.
Companies can't get together and do it.
The Fed sure. does do that with, yeah. with wage determination, and companies still don't pay it.
Right. Companies can't do this legally, but...
Yeah. If they get audited, they get in trouble.
Well, it wouldn't. I mean, if you guys, if a few company owners in an area, big companies, decided and got together and said, hey, you know, over beers, they said, we're not going to bid this much lower per acre. I mean, you're going to get audited. That's not going to be in your books. That's just going to be there. It's just going to be what you paid for the project.
Yeah, but listen, this is like prisoner's okay. dilemma, because as soon as the first owner who can rat out the other owners and not face the fines,
right.
will rat
listen,
them
everybody
out.
Everybody turns into like, a fucking lawyer when we start talking about all this stuff. But I'm talking about decency and humanity. Okay, that's all I'm saying.
I'm talking about criminality. Yeah, I'm not saying legality. I'm talking about like how you operate as a criminal
syndicate
here. Yeah,
we're talking about
here.
Breaking federal law.
I'm talking
right
about
now.
All right, so Doug and Sonia just
that's
said
not
it's
not a good thing.
So I'm just going to point out that Doug and Sonia just said it's criminal behavior to want to have your employees' best intentions in mind.
No,
so
that is not what we
that's
said.
That's what they just said. That's how I'm interpreting that.
That is not what we just said. We said we cannot break federal law.
Put it on a bumper sticker, Chris. I understand, but we can be decent human beings. And we can agree
we
as
can
company
be
owners.
Decent human beings.
Like I won't bid on a project if I think I won't bid a low point on a project, and I've been lowballed before, and I just move on to the next project. You know, I'm just simply not going to bid too low just to win the project, just to get another project in the door. I'm not going to do
there
it.
There are federal agencies that I will not bid for because all they do is award for low contract cost.
Sure.
And their low costs, their low bids are like $6 an acre. For a 15-meter transect interval in a really dense archaeological area, that's ridiculous.
Yeah.
That is incredibly ridiculous, and they know it.
Right.
But the feds award those contracts. So you know what? I won't bid on them. I flat out have told them, I will not bid on your projects because your award practices are unethical to the resource and to the crew.
Right.
So if you think that I'm being unfair to crews, well, you're gravely mistaken.
And on that note, I think we're going to end this podcast. We've gone long anyway. I'm just gonna say my one final thought on this is that it's all our responsibility. If you're sitting there complaining about the industry on Facebook, if you're complaining about anything, you're part of the problem. Because instead of complaining, do something to fix it. Because if employers aren't willing to, if you're working for an employer that is not willing to bid a price that's fair, that gets you paid well, then don't work for that employer. If you're an employer that's doing that, well, then you're probably going to get the bottom of the barrel for field techs. If you're going to bid on that shitty agency's project, you're going to get the bottom of the barrel, and you can't complain when you do that because you set that yourself. So we are an industry that is fighting amongst itself, and nobody's coming up with solutions. And all we keep throwing laws out at each other and saying, you can't do this and you can't do that, but we're not talking about what we can do. And we should just talking about what are our problems and what are the possible solutions to them. Let's just do it.
So start being constructive.
Criminal cartel. That's the way to do it.
Be constructive, people. Be. I know it's hard to be positive, but be constructive. Like, how can we make this better? We can't just make it better by paying people better all the time. That's not getting to the source of the problem. And the source of the problem is not always your boss or your boss's boss. Sometimes it goes all the way up to the top. And the only way that you can make that change is by electing different people.
Right. So if you own a company right now and you're listening to this, I'm going to get with Sonia after this recording. We're going to join our two companies together. We're going to bring yours into the fold as well. And we're just going to call it Big Archaeology. So so people can blame Big Archaeology and we'll actually just be that company. All right. Thanks a lot, guys, for your opinions on this. If you've got any other opinions out there, which I'm sure you've either jammed a trowel into your car stereo right now or smashed your phone on the ground so you haven't heard the end of this podcast.
We want to hear them.
Yes.
We want to hear your feedback. Please engage with us.
Yes. If you have any positive feedback, send it to chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. If it's negative, send it to Sonia and Doug. So,
okay.
No, I'm just kidding. I know. We want all your feedback and we really want to know. We want to start this conversation and keep it rolling, actually, and maybe enact some positive change. So thanks a lot, guys. And thanks for listening to this. And again, give us your feedback and we'll see you in 2 weeks.
That's it for another episode of the CRM Archaeology Podcast. Links to some of the items mentioned on the show are in the show notes for this podcast, which can be found at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/CRM Arc Podcast. If you like the show and want to comment, please do. You can leave comments about this or any other episode on the website or on the iTunes page for the episode. You can also email me at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com or use the contact form on the podcast webpage. If you'd like us to answer a question on a future episode, email us. Use the contact form on the website or tweet your questions with the hashtag CRM Arc Podcast, or you can tag @arcpodnet in your tweet. Please share the link to the show wherever you saw it. If you share CRM archaeology related items on Twitter or Facebook or anywhere else for that matter, be sure to use the hashtag CRMARC so the community can see and comment. If you'd like to subscribe to this podcast, you can do so on iTunes or on Stitcher Radio. You can also type the name of the podcast into your favorite podcasting app and subscribe that way. Don't forget to go over to iTunes and leave a review of the show. It helps us get noticed so more people can find our podcast and benefit from the content. Also, send us show suggestions and interview suggestions. We want this to be a resource for field technicians everywhere, and we want to know what you want to know about. Also, please consider donating to the Archaeology Podcast Network. Your donations help fund our bandwidth and contribute to our editing costs.
Thanks to everyone for joining me this week. Thanks also to the listeners for tuning in, and we'll see you in the field. Goodbye.
See ya.
Doug's not even unmuted yet. There's the countdown.
He's counting down. There it is.
Counting down.
And...
bye.
This show is produced and recorded by the Archaeology Podcast Network, Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle, in Reno, Nevada, at the Reno Collective.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.